Hi, this is Paula Morrell, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast.
There ain't no way for a middle-aged man to behave. There ain't no way for a middle-aged man to be acting when you already got one foot in the grave.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Justin McGoldrick with Frankie Cadillac on upright bass? Originally from Bendigo, Australia, Justin McGoldrick has made the South his home for the past 15 years. He has CDs for sale after the show, and more can be found at justinmcgoldrick.com. All right, well, welcome to Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. We are on the road and on location at the main stage in beautiful downtown Eureka Springs, Arkansas. Tales from the South is presented by William F. Lehman Public Library, and tonight's show is made possible in part by the Department of Arkansas Heritage and the Arkansas Arts Council's Arts on Tour program, and I'm your host, Paula Martin Morrell. On my left here, playing for us tonight, are local musicians Kirk and Kara Ashworth. Kirk and Kara moved to the Ozarks in the summer of 2008. They work in Berryville schools, play music, and fight spiders for fun. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? When we go on the road, we bring a few pieces of our permanent set with us. So that includes these amazing screen doors right here from her Images of the American South collection by Delta artist V.L. Cox. And also this mixed media piece right over here by Little Rock artist Carla McGoldrick. We also feature an artist from the area. So tonight's featured artist is Eureka Springs painter Denise Ryan. And our featured piece is the larger piece right over here, which is entitled North Wind, which is for sale. Our listeners can find out more about this piece and Denise at her website, artbydeniseryan.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern style storytelling? Tonight, all of our storytellers are from the Eureka Springs, Arkansas area and tell stories of various stages of interference. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who live them. Later tonight, Roger Shoffit's decision to interfere ends with a bang. And we'll end the night with M.B. McQueen and a stranger's plan to remove her hurdles. But let's start the night here at Tales from the South with Chris Hancock and his interference in his sister's affairs in Apple Trees and Their Proximities.
I was finally home for a weekend visit. It was strange to be home again, but good. I'd been gone long enough for home to reclaim an old newness. The furniture was different. My bedroom was now a guest room currently occupied by my now strangely older little sister, Anna, and a whole gaggle of her high school friends. Rather than a homecoming, it felt more like an intrusion on Anna's now busy social life. Mom and I hid out in the kitchen so to avoid any potential embarrassment we might haphazardly inflict. The guest room door opened and music and laughter rose with the swing of the door and hushed again as it closed. Anna tore through the kitchen with just a nod to acknowledge me, then turned to a grocery store bag and said to Mom, "Les pommes et fromage? Remember? I thought it would be ready by now." She stormed off. Mom said nothing, for all that I could tell she wanted to say. Her eyes narrowed in a way that betrayed what boiled beneath. Mom and Anna were alike in their assertive natures, so when they clashed, neither would yield. "What was that about?" I asked, hoping to defuse this somehow. She's so wound up about entertaining her guests. Mom began to unpack the grocery bag, Gala apples, a few blocks of different cheeses, and some crackers labeled entertainment crackers. "You know she's taking French now. It's great, really, and she has a gift for it, but for those of us not up on our French, it's getting annoying. I know she's stressed out about her little party, so I'll let that demanding tone slide for now, but we're going to have a talk about it later." I realize now that that sideways nod my sister had given me earlier was a complaint, because all my talking in here with Mom was messing up her appetizer schedule. I continued chopping potatoes for the roast, and Mom began slicing the apples, and there was only the sound of knives against the cutting boards. "You know, those apples look a lot like these potatoes when they're sliced up like that," I said. I don't think she would see the difference without the skins. Mom considered this, smiled, and without a word, she took my cutting board and I took hers. Mom nearly laughed once these potatoes and cheeses were plated with their entertainment crackers. Anna rushed in and took the plate in a thankless huff. Mom and I looked at each other, knowing we couldn't take them back now. "They're still palms," I said. "Really? Palms de terre. What's that mean?" "Roughly, dirt apples." We laughed and waited. Each second of suspense killed us. It took longer than we expected. As we waited, I felt something like guilt or regret as I imagined those poor girls in the guest room trying to choke down these potato slices, not wanting to tell my sister there was something off about these apples. Perhaps trying at first to pretend like they liked them, then watching as Anna finally samples one and questions it and asks around and wonders why no one told her or if it's just her. And gradually Anna will squeeze it out of her mean girl lieutenants that it's not just her, that these palms are Mao. Anna stomped back into the kitchen to tell Mom the apples were bad, like a maitre d' scolding the sous chef. Mom hee-hawed. This was the punchline she'd been waiting for. "No," she said when she got a breath, "you're the bad apple." "Mal Palm," I said, and I immediately regretted opening my mouth. As Anna's eyes cut at me and I realized too late that I had incriminated myself in this bad apple fiasco. "Mal pomme de terre," said Mom, really enjoying herself now. "Bad potato," Anna growled. She was indignant. "Dirt apple is a more accurate translation," Mom added, really, really enjoying herself now. I again felt the anxiety that surrounds their clash of wills. "It's just a little prank, take it easy," I told her. This only affirmed to my sister that it was I that was truly to blame. "Do you realize how embarrassing it will be to go back in there and tell my friends that they just ate raw potatoes because you thought it would be funny?" Now I had to defend myself. I couldn't see the moral high ground that justified the prank in the first place. "Oh, it's harmless," I said, making light of her near fatal embarrassment. "Surely your friends have heard of a prank. And really, you had it coming after the way you barked at Mom about your palms et fromage. You can slice an apple, right?" I was at the top of my game, ready for anything this scary, smart sister of mine might throw, until she let out a long, diffusive, seemingly French sigh. And without heat, the coup de grace, "I wish you hadn't come back." She turned and moseyed like a lonesome sheriff back to her guests. Damn, she's good. She's so grown up. "Yes, I'm afraid so," said Mom. "Well, now I'm the bad dirt apple." I had hoped this would cue Mom to assure me that I was not the bad apple, but she just weighed the possibility with a shrug of her shoulders. "Well, you know what they say about apples and trees. You're the tree, Mom," I countered. Mom didn't dispute this. "There's Joseph," I said, hearing the sound of our middle brother's truck in the driveway. "The one good apple," I thought. "If he'd been here, none of this would have happened. He can take some of the blame for his absence, at least." I began dutifully chopping apples. I sliced the rest of the cheeses and opened a new sleeve of entertainment crackers. I drafted Joseph, the golden apple, to deliver these hors d'oeuvres because the cut of Anna's victorious eyes would have been too much for me. I made a quick trip to the store and searched for anything French. I was looking to buy some sort of dignified apology off the shelf, but there wasn't anything like that in the limited inventory of our small town grocery. So I settled instead for some sparkling grape juice from Altus and some real wine for the rest of us. Some coffee for the French press we never used, some overpriced chocolates, Dijon mustard and baguettes for finger sandwiches, and I hope that this might say sorry.
Chris Hancock's day job is marketing communications, and he is a freelance copywriter and editor with Walter Meyer Hancock. He has also been the social media editor for the Toadsuck Review and fiction editor for the Nude Bruce Review. Chris is an Arkansas native. Next on Tales from the South, Roger Shoffit and friends decide interfering is better than leaving well enough alone in Flower Power.
This story begins on a hot summer afternoon in 1959. I was hanging out with the Freitag brothers, Porkchop and Spud. We were killing time shooting flies with our homemade rubber band guns. Porkchop noticed a wasp without hesitation, knocked it out of the air on his first shot. Impressed by his feat, it dawned on us that this was an adversary worthy of our hostile intent and could offer a bit more excitement than nailing flies. There was a wasp nest as big as your head in one of our favorite climbing trees. It seemed eliminating it would be a public service to the whole community. We crept under the tree and could clearly see our target. Sure enough, there was a fat nest full of yellow-banded she-devils. The problem was, you had to stand directly under the nest to get a clear shot. Since Porkchop was a marksman, we chose him to go first. Spud and I stood back about 20 feet as Porkchop targeted the nest. He was using his heavy-duty rubber band gun with surgical tubing. It was the elephant gun of rubber band guns, and it packed quite a wallop. He crept up to the tree, carefully took aim, and shot. He dislodged a portion of the nest, which unfortunately was followed by an angry cloud of wasps pursuing us halfway down the block. When we were finally able to approach the tree again, we discovered the nest was still there and now full of very angry wasps. This only inflamed our desire to eliminate them without being stung. Realizing our poultry rubber band guns wouldn't work to vanquish our foe, we'd have to find other means. It's amazing what three 12-year-olds raised during the Cold War era can come up with. I remembered I had a cigar box full of firecrackers left over from the 4th of July and considered that this might be useful in our endeavor. After brainstorming, we decided to make a large firecracker out of a couple hundred of the small ones. We spent the next hour unrolling and amassing the powder. Next, we rolled and packed the powder in a cigar-shaped charge, placed it in a toilet paper roll, topped it off with flour, and then wrapped the whole thing with a roll of tape. We put on 3 feet of slow-burning fuse, which we figured made for adequate ignition and escape time. We chose to put the flour in the charge, thinking it would create a fireball that would fry any survivors from the initial blast. We had made this discovery when, on a previous pyrotechnic experiment, we blew up a bag of flour with a cherry bomb. The only problem with our plan was selecting a volunteer. They had to deftly place the charge as close as possible without getting stung. Although slightly damaged from our earlier assault, the nest was massive and covered with hundreds of easily provoked females with bad attitudes and suspicious nature. Spud drew the short straw, and without complaint, he slowly climbed the tree, toilet paper roll bomb clenched in his teeth. He inched within a couple of feet of the nest and then carefully placed the charge directly under the nest, lit the fuse, and then descended the tree in seconds. The only way he could have gotten down faster is if he'd fell out of the tree. We waited with great anticipation, but the fuse was really slow. After about 10 minutes, we began to wonder if the fuse had gone out, but no one wanted to climb up and check. After a few more seconds of anxious anticipation, our dilemma was compounded when we heard my dad pull up in the driveway at the front of the house. Great, now what? Without time to defuse the situation, we did what any kid would do. We panicked. At first, we ran around in circles and into each other, and then in desperation, dashed in the house, grabbed comic books, and tried to look like we'd been there all day. Within seconds, Dad popped in the house. Y'all up to no good? You should be outside playing. Nah, we're just hanging out. It's too hot out, was all I could manage to say in the calmest voice I could muster. Porkchop and Spud remained silent, heads in the comic books. It was at that moment that the bomb went off. I'm sure it sent a shockwave through the neighborhood. The explosion was a lot louder than we had expected, since it rattled every window in the house. The ensuing fireball illuminated the surroundings as it rolled up into the ether. Dad just gazed dumbfounded at the sight of our next-door neighbor's tree as it burst into flames. "Well, I'll be damned," he uttered. Then he looked back at us with a suspicious eye. Later, upon reflection, I wondered if flights were diverted from the nearby airport due to the mushroom cloud. Fortunately for us, we seemed to have a good alibi, although I'm not really sure Dad believed us. It seemed like something we would do. He was still hard-pressed to explain to our neighbors how his tree went up in flames and how we weren't involved. I believed we used a skosh too much flour, since the explosion and fire destroyed half the foliage of the tree. The wasps never had a chance. They were consumed in the Holocaust, nest and all. One might say on that day in the late 50s that we discovered flower power, which dazzled us until the 60s when we discovered a different kind of flower power and a whole range of new distractions.
Roger Shoffit was born and raised in Houston, Texas, and moved to Eureka Springs in 1980 with his wife Annie and daughter Sarah. He was the owner of the Spring Gallery for 31 years. Now retired, Roger lives in Beaver, Arkansas, where he spends as much time as possible fishing, painting, gardening, and spending quality time with his three dogs. In our final story of the night here at Tales from the South, it's a stranger that interferes to remove M.B. McQueen's inhibitions in Heaven and Hell.
I turned 50. I'd been gearing up to write about it for quite a while, but when the time came, I just had too many mixed emotions to do it. For one thing, it was difficult even typing the numbers. I was going to go all Roman numeral and just start telling people that I was L, but that seemed a little lame. Pig Latin is kind of a dead language, so Ifty Fay wasn't going to cut it either. My boyfriend said, "Tell me what you want to do on your birthday, and we'll do it." But my mind went as blank as Paris Hilton's facial expression. I decided to post an ad in the Rants and Raves section of Craigslist asking for ideas and got a few responses. "Go skydiving. Stay at this lodge. Watch this porn video." It was, after all, Craigslist. Then someone wrote and said something like, "Shame on you for thinking that 50 is ancient. You should go camping in the woods with some friends and just enjoy the day. Eat some s'mores." I liked it. We decided to go to the Buffalo River. I sensed that a bottle of champagne might enhance the whole nature experience, so that was in the plans too. But in the end, my beau had a flat tire, and we ended up at Sears instead. "Actually, this is good," he said. "I wanted you to shop for your gift anyway. You like clothes, so I figured you could buy some." It was a little overwhelming. A whole mall at my disposal? I'm underemployed and semi-practical, so I decided to buy some new undergarments. I hadn't done any serious foundation shopping since my last midlife crisis birthday 2 years earlier. But being that it was my big 5-0, I figured I'd forego the Sears industrial granny panties and Teflon bras and head for Victoria's Secret instead. I'd never actually shopped there, and gee, it was my birthday. I stood basking in the beauty of all the silky, lacy shininess and was greeted by a middle-aged, friendly-looking woman. "May I help you?" she asked. "Well," I told her, "it's my birthday, and I need some bras." She grabbed my hand and said, "You come with me." She dragged me back to the pink Victoria's Secret dressing room, and I confided to her my desire for cleavage and the $5 for $25 panty special. My new friend measured me and studied my upper torso, you know, the part where the boobs are. I looked at her badge. "Kitty," it said. "What a happy-sounding name." "We're gonna fix you right up," she said cheerily, and told me she'd be right back. Kitty was gonna save me. I just knew it. I have to tell you that I was a bit anxiety-ridden. For one thing, I'm not exactly used to having carte blanche with a charge card. I didn't want to spend a lot of my boyfriend's loot, though he'd given me no limit. Secondly, I'd lost some weight since that last birthday bra thing, and I'm having body image issues. Losing weight means losing boobage, so I knew that I was down at least a half a cup size. Oh yeah, and I just turned L. The first bra Kitty brought was too big, the second was too small, and the third was just right. Okay, now we have a starting point, she said. I'll be right back. She returned with a handful of gorgeous late model numbers with all the bells and whistles. Solids, prints, lace, underwire, minimal padding, convertible straps, a built-in CD player, and one... and one that made me look like Dolly Parton's little sister. The price tags ranged from $45 to $85, which made me choke a little. Oh gosh, I said in wonder, trying on the Dolly Sis model and studying my silhouette. This bra could totally change my life. Kitty smiled knowingly. But it's a lie, I said. I need a more honest bra. Plus, Kitty, I have to tell you that while I know a lot of your customers come in and spend tons of money, I just can't do it. I need something more practical, like your two-for-one special. Infinitely patient, she left and came back with some bras that were more Ford Taurus than Mercedes. They were still beautiful, but much more simple than the others she had shown me. I tried one on. It didn't alter my universe, but it was nice. Still, looking into the mirror, I grimaced. 50. Sigh. I've gone down a whole cup size, I confided. Listen, said my new best friend ever. You have to put this all into perspective. There are women who come in here who've had mastectomies. They have no breasts at all. And you have to stop worrying so much. You look beautiful. Chin up, shoulders back. Enjoy your day. I knew at that moment that I loved Kitty with all my heart and soul. She really was lovely. She looked like a former stripper, kind of faded and world-weary, with big blonde hair and a warm smile. Okay, I said, I'll take two, black and taupe. She rolled her eyes. Get a pattern. Do something fun. I really can't afford fun, I said. I have to go functional. But I swear, Kitty, I'll pick out fun panties, at least one pair. We went and got my sensible colored bras, four solid colored panties, and one as a concession to my newfound friend with a butterfly print on it. I was still a little anxious about the cost of all this and about the whole day in general. I headed back to the dressing room to gather up my things, Kitty following behind. She wasn't through counseling me. You know, you have to get a grip on this, she said. We have teenage girls coming in here who are getting their armpits liposuctioned. What kind of priorities are those? I know, I replied, secretly adding armpit lipo to my plastic surgery wish list. I know none of it matters at all. There are people starving all over the world, and I'm worried about turning 50. But the way I'm feeling is just temporary. I'll adjust. I know you will, hon, she said. You are so great, Kitty, I told her. You've really made my day. We were both getting all teary-eyed bonding over those bras. You are too, and I'm sorry for lecturing, but you wouldn't believe what I see and hear working at this place. She paused thoughtfully for a moment, then asked, how old do you think I am? 65. I was shocked. She appeared at least 10 years younger. What I've learned is this. You have to be happy within yourself. None of this stuff matters. She motioned around the cute little dressing room. Oh, how I adored my philosopher bra sales lady. We sniffled. It was such a touching conversation. Then, I find my happiness with him, she said, pointing up to the ceiling of the dressing room. At first, I thought she meant some roofer or something. But then I realized she meant the man upstairs, the one above them all. Uh-oh. Do you know him? Do you read the Bible? No, and I'm really not into organized religion. Neither am I, she said. But, you know, you have to make a decision. Do you want to go to heaven or do you want to go to hell? Great. Yet another decision to make. I couldn't even figure out which bra to buy, for Pete's sake. I groaned inwardly. She was trying to save me in the Victoria's Secret dressing room. I love stuff like this, but at the same time, I hate it because when very righteous people find out that I'm a dyed-in-the-wool heathen, it often ruins the mood. Well, see, I have a problem with that concept too, but I do see what you're saying, and I am listening. For a moment, I considered the fact that if getting saved meant that I stayed as well-preserved as Kitty, it might just be worth looking into. She looked at me sadly for a moment, shook her head, then left the dressing room without a word. I gathered up my purse, my two bras, and five panties, and went to the register. My boyfriend met me there, and I told him about my fabulous sales lady. A cashier rang up my birthday gifts and put them into one of those adorable pink striped bags. "Wait," I said before we left. "I want to go thank Kitty and tell her goodbye." I looked around the entire shop, but she was nowhere to be found. Nowhere. Poof. It was a little spooky. Had she even existed? Had she been sent as some sort of birthday present from God? Wow, I told my boyfriend as we left the store. I think I met a real live Victoria's Secret angel.
M.B. McQueen is a writer, humorous blogger, and awful poet whose work has appeared in various magazines and newspapers. Since writing this story, she's aged 2 years, married her boyfriend, and gained back a few of the pounds she lost. Originally from Memphis, Tennessee, she now lives in the Ozark Mountains in northwest Arkansas. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers. Thank you to our live audience here at the main stage in Eureka Springs, Arkansas. And thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by William F. Lehman Public Library. And our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Tonight's show is sponsored by the Writers Colony at Dairy Hollow and the Arkansas Club at the Queen Anne, and made possible in part by the Department of Arkansas Heritage and the Arkansas Arts Council's Arts on Tour program. Additional support provided by UALR's Department of Rhetoric and Writing, the Argenta Arts Foundation, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
I thought I knew a lot about the folk scene, you know. And I stumbled upon this lady I'd never heard of, just called Karen Dalton, who Bob Dylan said to him was a better songwriter. He said she had a voice gutsier than him, you know. But then I found out that she ended up dying of HIV on the streets of New York. Penniless, pretty much, you know. So I had to write the ballad of Karen Dalton. In a little timber shack out on a Colorado mountainside, no way of knowing the way that you die. Your native raw spirit filled with so much pride. Man, I wish I had known you, Karen Dalton. With a cigarette between your lips, whiskey bottle at your hip, yellow stained fingertips, I wish I had known you, Karen Dalton. You're a woman of true grit in a cruel man's world. All around you the myths and the legends they swirl. High cheekbones and buckskin pants on a black-haired girl. I wish I had known you, Karen Dalton. You got a cigarette between your lips and yellow-stained fingertips, a whiskey bottle at your hip. I wish I had known you, Karen Dalton. Well, you made it back to New York in your last days. You lost a couple of teeth somewhere along the way. You're sleeping on the streets and in the cold subways. I wish I had known you, Karen Dalton. With your cigarette between your lips and a whiskey bottle at your hip, yellow stained fingertips. I wish I had known you, Karen Dalton. I'm glad in the end you had somewhere to stay, someone to help you keep all them demons at bay. Maybe I'll still get to meet you up in heaven someday. I wish I had known you, Karen Dalton, with a cigarette between your lips and a whiskey bottle at your hip, yellow stained fingertips. Wish I had known you, Karen Dalton. Wish I had known you, Karen Dalton.
Studio assistance provided by Infrared Studio Productions. Experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. Schedule and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive, and we'll see you next week for another edition of Tales from the South.